The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Monday, July 29th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The president, Trump, Donald Trump, called Baltimore, Maryland, filthy, infested, and he had proof. A supporter of his, Terrence Williams, 500,000 Twitter followers, tweeted a video of a house in Baltimore, and this house, are you ready, had a messy lawn. To be fair, it was really messy, like really messy. So, by that logic, the 5th District of Kentucky is infested with trucks that have no tires. No tires, shame on you. What? What's that snowy-haired Republican Hal Rogers, dean of the Kentucky delegation? What are you doing? Your state and district is statistically last. It's actually third to last, but is lower than Baltimore. But of course, Donald Trump would never call out Hal Rogers because, well, of course, you know why. But Mick Mulvaney didn't know why or pretended not to know. He offered this great argument in defense of his boss on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace.
So, Chris, help me with this. When the president attacks AOC plus three, when he attacks the squad last week, he gets accused of being a racist. When Nancy Pelosi does it a few days later, the left and many members of the media, not you in particular, I'd make that clear, come to Nancy's defense how it couldn't possibly be racist. That she was.
Chris wasn't buying it. But Mulvaney, undeterred, tried the same argument again on CBS, where Margaret Brennan was really not buying it.
Well, keep in mind, about 2 weeks ago, the president said things that were critical of AOC and her squad and was immediately accused of being a racist. A couple days later, Nancy Pelosi said some things critical of that same group of people, and she was defended by the media and by folks on the left for not being racist. When Donald Trump...
No human being would want to live there.
When Donald Trump attacks
this
people...
This is being perceived as racist. Do you understand why?
Wait a minute. Chris. And by Chris, I don't mean you, Chris, personally, but someone named Chris, like maybe Cuomo. How come when Trump says Baltimore is uninhabitable by humans, people think it's racist? But when Nancy Pelosi, who's from Baltimore, says the squad is a pain in her ass, she's seen as not racist. Even after AOC qualifies, oh yeah, she's not racist. Why is that? Because the media. And also, how come when Al Jolson wore blackface, it was racist? But when a black person doesn't even wear any makeup, no one says it's racist. And why is, and riddle me this, and I don't mean to personally put you on the spot, Chris. You're aces with me. But clear this up for me, Chris. How come when the Klan burns a cross, it's racist, but when 80s pop singer Christopher Cross plays Clash of Clans on the computer, no one calls that racist? Why does the media have that double standard of objectively reporting on the substance of a statement rather than just repeating what my boss thinks is true? Why? This, by the way, is told, is exactly the debate Trump wants to be having. But why is it then that when anyone accuses him of playing three-dimensional chess, they're seen as idiots, but when someone asserts he's a pawn, chess piece, of the Russians, that's seen as plausible? Why is that? On the show today, the fiery, impassioned call to arms that is foregoing impeachment. Spoiler, it's kind of unemotional and empirical. But first, Tim Alberta of Politico is here to talk about his new book, which explains Trump by going backwards in time to the primordial swamp of Republican politics of the preceding decade. Alberta has sources, and I hope I'm using this right. He brought receipts. Also, John Boehner reads Mark Meadows. I really do hope I'm using that right. American Carnage. It is generally all around us, but specifically here today in the form of American Carnage on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. Up next. American Carnage. That was a line from the Trump inaugural address. It drew this review from former President George W. Bush. Quote, that was some weird shit. It sure was. But just how far back the shit goes and just how weird it is the subject of Tim Alberta's new book, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump Tim Albert has been here before. He's the chief political correspondent for Politico. I was telling Tim a little before we started, I think it's the best book of its kind during the Trump presidency. It's deeply reported. And Tim also brings, I would use the phrase a gimlet eye, but he is sort of your companion along this journey. He has the full trust of the sources that he talks to, but then kind of turns around and steps aside and puts it in a context that you can understand. Thank you, Tim, for joining me.
Hey, Mike. Thanks a lot for having me.
So you were reporting on the Republicans in Congress for National Review from when? When did you start really getting to know this cast of characters?
Well, actually, way before I went to National Review, my stint at National Review was actually really, really brief. I covered basically the final year of the 2016 campaign for National Review, basically like November to November.
And, mm-hmm.
But I had been covering Republicans and the conservative movement basically since I got to Washington back in 2009. And that was sort of not totally intentional at first. I was very much fascinated by this out-of-power party whose president, George W. Bush, was kind of leaving office with his tail between his legs, and the party was totally rudderless and beaten into the ground by Obama and the Democrats in 08, and they had nowhere to go. And, you know, for all the attention being paid to Obama and the Democratic majorities, for obvious reasons, because they were the one making the laws, there was this incredible story happening in the Republican Party, in part because of this sort of disillusionment with George W. Bush, certainly this disillusionment and resentment toward the elites in the party that had been sort of simmering below surface level. So anyway, it's a long way of answering your question, but I had basically dumped about 10 years of notebooks into writing this book.
Yeah. And it seems to me that a couple observations. One, you like Boehner and he likes you, although a lot of people like Boehner. Two,
he's a hard guy not to like.
I think so. Two, Paul Ryan is someone that you see maybe a little bit differently from the caricature, and you try to, well, you impart to the reader that this is a sincere person who has deeply held beliefs and was really trying, and the deeply held beliefs, by the way, are not about cruelty, you know, is deeply trying to do substantive things to improve the lot of all Americans. I think that comes through. And then, so if that's a basis, and maybe my listeners are saying, what is he in the bag for them? Then you look at a bunch of the Tea Party members, and I think individually, full portraits of all of them come out.
Yeah, you know, and obviously Ryan is a starring character in this drama, and people probably cringe when they hear you say, oh, you know, an inherently decent person, what is that? Look, I think kind of the irony, Mike, is that Paul Ryan became public enemy number one to the left during the Trump administration in many ways because there was a recognition that he is sort of an inherently decent person. Ryan, obviously, during Trump's ascent in 2016, was a chief critic of Trump, calling him out all the time. And they had this long-running rivalry during late 2015 and much of 2016. And Ryan, among other things, basically called him a racist, which then, Mike, made the whiplash that much more severe when he sort of does this 180 when Trump wins. And it's not that he does a 180 on his ethics or his morals necessarily as much as it is he does a 180 on his approach to Trump. Right. He basically decides that he's got this binary decision on election night 2016. Do I continue to, you know, speak out every time this guy does and says something that I view as immoral or unethical or inappropriate or whatever? And in so doing, lose my job as Speaker of the House because there's just no way I'm going to be able to survive. He barely survived as it was. Or, you know, do I swallow those criticisms? And by swallowing those criticisms, I can become the second most powerful Republican in a unified Republican government. I will have basically all of the policymaking outsourced to me in my office. I will have at least this 2-year window to pursue my legislative white whales. And for Ryan, that was a really easy choice. He didn't think twice about it from every bit of reporting I have. It was a no-brainer for him. And obviously, the reputation that he had spent decades building up in Washington was, I think, sort of tarnished by his decision to sort of make this deal with the devil, as his friends described it, to sort of go along with Trump.
Well, I could hear a lot of my listeners kind of saying to themselves, you know, I'm so sick of this. I am so sick of the notion that Ben Sasse is a decent guy or Paul Ryan's a decent guy or all these people are supposedly decent guys. And then they say something that maybe in their hearts is meaningful but has no substance. And they really do nothing to substantively stop Trump and they do nothing to shame him and they do nothing to break with their party. Is there something, let's just take Ryan and not all the rest of them. Is there there really something he could have done more?
I just talked about the legislative opportunity that he saw at hand, which was no doubt part of the reason that he kind of went silent on Trump and wanted to work alongside of him. But there's another huge component to it, Mike, that's actually probably an even bigger component in my conversations with Ryan and with people around Ryan, which is to say that he basically was scared of what the government would look like if there weren't responsible people around Donald Trump. Now, that may sound like a line of crap. It might sound like a total cop-out to some of your listeners, and I'm not here to defend it. I am simply relaying what has been told to me repeatedly by folks who are sort of in the room for these situations. And it is plausible because, look, Reince Priebus would say the same thing. We're trying to make lemonade here. I did everything I could to keep Trump from being elected. I never wanted him to be the president, but I did feel a certain responsibility to try and help the institutions of government survive. And people don't want to hear that, and for good reason, because there is still just a fundamental failure to speak out at times when somebody needed to speak out, and not a Justin Amash and not a Mark Sanford, not even a Jeff Flake, a member of the U.S. Senate, but somebody in a real position of leadership to stand up and say, look, this is not okay. And I am going to support the president on X, Y, and Z. I appreciate what the White House is doing on A, B, and C, but I cannot stand for this. This is not my party. This is not my country. And I completely disagree with what the president's trying to do here. And if you lose your job, then you lose your job. I just think that obviously that is the criticism that many people will have today and 20 years from now and 100 years from now when they're looking back on this period.
Now, another great thing that your book does is it talks about the party, but it also talks about the party through the prism of the populist or strongman or a loudmouth, the person who gets so much media attention. And a lot of people have rightly said, you know, Sarah Palin was a precursor. But you also talk about the Tea Party activists, the Tea Party members of Congress who get so much attention on Fox News, right? That's a force amplifier. You have this scene where John Boehner, who in the book is so profane, I guess, in real life. He says, how am I supposed to negotiate? I have no dick. She had me by the balls. Everything is, you're shitting me. Love the guy. So anyway, so John Boehner goes to Roger Ailes and says, you've got to stop putting Michelle Bachmann on the air so much. You've got to stop putting Ro Labrador on the air. I can't get anything done with these people getting so much attention, and you're the ones giving them attention. And what does Roger Ailes say?
Well, Roger Ailes essentially says, look, man, I don't tell the talent, i.e. Hannity and O'Reilly and some of the others, I don't tell them what to do. They've got kind of a well-oiled ratings machine here, and I'm not going to mess with them. And so Ailes and Boehner, they go way back. These guys are buddies. And, you know, Ailes doesn't seem to appreciate just how desperate Boehner has become because, you know, Fox News is in many ways sort of the home base of this conservative insurgency that is beginning to swallow the party up whole. And Ailes isn't really hearing it. Ailes isn't going to accommodate him. So Boehner goes to his ace in the hole. Now, this is in the spring of 2014, and nobody had yet learned that there was going to be a select committee to investigate the Benghazi terrorist attacks yet. It had not been announced. And so Boehner kind of dangles it out in front of him to try and entice Ailes to listen to him about the bookings. And he says, look, Roger, we're trying to do some good things in the House. We're going to really go after the Democrats. Matter of fact, we're going to form this select committee on Benghazi that's going to prove, you know, torturous to Hillary Clinton as she's trying to get her presidential campaign off the ground. And Boehner thinks that this is going to help him. But of course, it completely backfires because as soon as Boehner says the word Benghazi, he trips a switch inside of Ailes, who I don't think it's been widely appreciated just what a conspiracy theorist Ailes really was.
Or became. Right. And when you said that, right, Ailes doesn't really appreciate what a tough bind Boehner is in terms of these extreme members of his caucus. I think Boehner, who probably goes way back to Ohio days with Ailes, and Ailes is, you know, this big Nixon surrogate and supporter, and Nixon, you know, by today's standards, really quite moderate. I think maybe Boehner thinks he's dealing with a more rational actor than Ailes was by, you know, the last few years of his life.
That's exactly right. That's a perfect way of putting it. And, you know, Boehner, he understands that there are some characters in his conference, let's put it that way, right, in the House GOP. And he understands that there are some true believers in birtherism, for example. I mean, Boehner has this great line where he talks about Congress whenever people are kind of upset or scratching their heads and thinking about Congress. And Boehner says, look, It's nothing more than a slice of the American people. There are some of the nicest folks you'd ever meet and some of the meanest, some of the smartest folks you'd ever meet and some of the dumbest. It's just a reflection of America, which, as a guy who's covered Congress a long time, he's exactly right. That is 1,000% what Congress is. And Boehner has come to think of, you know, the birthers as an example, as just these fringe characters. You know, it's the Louis Gohmerts in the party, but it's not mainstream. There aren't smart people who actually subscribe to this stuff. But then he's talking with Ailes, and Ailes starts going off about how Obama really was born in Kenya and how, in fact, this whole thing is a Manchurian candidate situation and how the Obama White House knows what he knows. And so the Obama administration has been spying on him and how he has armed guards at his house, worried that the government might try and come after him. And this is Ailes spilling all of this to Boehner at the mention of the word Benghazi. And Boehner is just sitting there thinking, holy shit, like this is – Roger has lost his mind. And Boehner leaves the meeting more convinced than ever that Fox News is not just like a threat to, you know, Republicanism, but a threat to the Republic in some ways.
Yeah. So in 2016, a good percentage of the Republican Party and establishment didn't show up to the convention. In 2020, I predict that almost everyone who considers themselves a Republican and a viable Republican will show up. Now, this can be attributed to the idea that the Republican Party is now the party of Trump. But I want to break that down to figure out what it really means. How much is it that in 2016, the general notion was this is a failing campaign and we shouldn't attach ourselves to it, versus in 2020, this is, you know, we have a plausible shot at victory and he's already, you know, delivered victory unto us?
That's a good question. He did give Republicans to conservative Supreme Court justices. He did give them deregulation. He did deliver to the evangelical community more than George W. Bush did in 8 years. Trump gave them in probably his first 18 months with executive orders on religious liberty and conscious stuff and abortion policy domestically and internationally and where the funding goes for certain programs. What's really remarkable, and I document some of this in the book, is that, you know, some of the people who were just absolutely, you know, dragged along kicking and screaming to voting for Trump, including some pretty prominent conservatives and Christian leaders, they're now some of his most outspoken allies. And they have totally come around and said, you know, this guy has delivered on every promise he's made. And they sort of act as though the other stuff doesn't even exist. So you're right. The 2020 convention is going to be a party. The 2016 convention felt like a funeral in some respects. And you did have all of these establishment figures boycott it. There was only one living former Republican presidential nominee to show up, which is insane to think about. And in 2020, you know, yes, symbolically, it'll sort of cement the fact that it's fully Trump's party. But I think also it'll cement the fact that in the eyes of many Republicans, the juice was worth the squeeze, or at least the good has outweighed the bad.
Yes, good orange imagery. Last question I want to ask you about. The squad, progressives within the Democratic Party, there are obvious parallels to what went on with the Republican Party in that people from the far right, or at least temperamentally, who were quite willing to pick fights with the establishment, created problems, maybe demanded some ideological purity at the expense of political reality or expedience. All that's true. My question is, what do you think the big differences are? So we have some fundamental parallels. How are the progressives within the Democratic Party different from what you saw in the Republican Party? I'll throw one idea out there, smarts and responsibility, but I don't know if that's true. You take it.
Well, I would start here, actually, Mike. The biggest difference to me, and this is foundational and people have to appreciate this, is that these progressives did not deliver the majority for Democrats in 2018, whereas the conservatives did deliver the majority in 2010. It was almost, not all, but a huge chunk of that freshman class, they were these conservative renegades who were coming in and sort of storming Washington, and they were sort of the majority of that new majority. Whereas in this case, with the Democrats circa 2019, it's a very, very vocal minority. I mean, when Pelosi says sort of dismissively, well, this is just these four people, I mean, she ain't wrong. Like, she got beat up for saying that, and maybe it was dismissive, but she's not wrong. Like, she, you know, Pelosi is speaking for the overwhelming majority of her conference. The problem is, It doesn't matter. Even that super vocal minority led by AOC, they are changing the party in real time. And whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's just the reality of it. And obviously, that is, in a way, sort of the Trump effect on American politics. We are through the looking glass here, and I don't think we're ever going back.
Tim Alberta is chief political correspondent of Politico. His new book is American Carnage: On the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. And I just want to note, though we mentioned Trump here and there, I don't think I asked one question on Trump specifically, and we didn't delve too deeply on Trump as a person or Trump during the campaign, even though the book does. My point being, there's so much else around and before Trump to explain Trump that is getting a little bit of short shrift, but a corrective will be Tim's book. Tim, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike.
And now the spiel. One after effect of the Mueller bummer was that the calls for impeachment, consequence be damned, grew louder, but also more diffuse. Each individual urging the party to impeach saw this as his or her most desperate hour, and into that abyss he would roar. Calls to impeach, which haven't swayed more than a double-digit number of the 235 Democrats in Congress, were all around us. Often, it was framed as an exercise in courage versus cowardice. Here's Elise Jordan on MSNBC.
I think that this is really an existential crisis for Democrats. They need to get over their hesitation, and they need to be ruthless. They need to be firm. They need to start prosecuting Donald Trump.
Not firm. It's the jelly in their belly that makes the prospect of impeaching smelly. Here's Elise again, daring them to man and woman up.
You have so many various transgressions and examples of corruption that Democrats look weak if they don't pursue it. And they still need.
Also on MSNBC, because, you know, Dems are watching. Here was Jason Johnson of The Root.
You had Democrats take a huge hit in 2010 for voting for the health care, you know, the Affordable Care Act, and it was a huge problem. Does anyone actually think that 31 Democrats are going to lose their seat for voting for impeachment? I doubt it. That impeachment is not as unpopular as the Affordable Care Act was 9 years ago. So given the constitutional needs, I don't understand this calculation.
I agree. You don't understand it. It's not about holding on to Democratic seats in the House, though I do think some of those would be in peril, too. It's about that one guy occupying that one oversized plush seat on Pennsylvania Avenue. Here's Chuck Todd quoting pro-impeachment opinion writer Andrew Sullivan.
Pelosi has set an extraordinary precedent that clear evidence meticulously collected that a president has committed what the she calls crimes against the Constitution does not constitute sufficient grounds for impeachment, even when those crimes were designed to cover up an alliance with a foreign power. If more than that is needed, the impeachment power has effectively been nullified. This gets to the.
So that's not exactly playing the you cowards card, but it does elide the difference between the necessity of impeachment and an act that would be sufficient to dispense with Trump. My problem is, as I've said before, it's easy to go all scorched earth, pell-mell, Hail Mary, hell-bent for leather, big swing, last stand, screw your courage to the sticking place, call to righteousness, stand up for bravery, accountability, and duty in favor of impeachment. The passions, the slogans, the quite possible frittering away of the 2020 election. On the other side, well, I had to laugh when Chuck Todd hit us with this phrase.
The Democrats' dilemma: avoid impeachment hearings and risk the wrath of their base, or go ahead and risk the wrath of moderate voters. Panel is next.
The wrath of the moderate voters. Wrath, I'm going to say it's maybe peak at best. We moderates don't seem to operate with wrath or passion. We're weak, cowardly, milquetoast types who are ready for this. Big insult hurled at Pelosi a lot. We're calculating. Such a bad trait to be calculating. We rely on evidence. We utilize empirical situations to come to correct conclusions. I would love to be able to come up with the angry, passionate case to not impeach. But you want an active verb, right? You want to fire the first shot. You don't want a prescription of what not to do, like don't shoot yourself in the foot. You want a call to arms. Spike Lee directed a movie that echoes what a lot of the pro-impeachment forces are arguing. Do the right thing! Spike Lee did not direct a movie called Forestall Unnecessary and Unpopular Actions, which could imperil your ultimate cause. He did direct a movie called Crooklyn, which could apply to the Trumps. I have no pithy way to encapsulate the wrath of the moderates, but I gotta say, I'm pretty sick of mistaking courage for stupidity, or at least bad choices. How is it that members of the Squad and the Progressive Caucus are the ones who are always described with the courage and the fire? Why is honoring their righteous calls for impeachment, or even the original vote that earned them some moderate Pelosi wrath, which was voting against the border bill, why does that confer upon them courage when the vote of every single representative and later the vote of the majority of representatives on the border funding bill contradicted them? Why is it that they are strong and everyone else is weak? The Squad are four representatives of color. They took a courageous stand. They were called courageous, and Pelosi was called quite the opposite. So Pelosi called them out. But let me ask you, why does the Squad deserve more backing and more cover from their Speaker of the House than Representatives Lauren Underwood, Lucy McBath, Antonio Delgado? Why are Underwood, McBath, and Delgado, who voted for the funding bill, who have not supported impeachment, why are they calculating cowards? Here's the theory why. Because they serve districts that were Republican 9 months ago, that could quite easily turn Republican again, as opposed to the brave souls who represent districts that voted Democrat by 20, 30, 40 points. It is a bit easier to scream and jump up and down when the floor beneath you is solid steel. When you're standing atop a rickety thin bridge, maybe you need to step a little bit lighter. It doesn't make you a coward. It just doesn't make you an idiot. So when you think of the vigilant guardians of the Constitution, sure, your mind goes to Presley or Tlaib or AOC. But when your mind conjures the cowards, please don't think of cautious Nancy or calculating Steny. How about conjuring up Delgado, McBath, Underwood? What's their flaw? What's their cowardice? Why is there no fire in their collective belly? How come they don't care about the Constitution like AOC and Ayanna Pressley and Ilhan Omar do? What, do McBath, Delgado, and Underwood like Trump? Maybe the answer is a little more nuanced than who's courageous and who's craven. So that, from me, was a little bit of wrath. Not in moderation, but on behalf of the moderates. And that's it for today's show. Now, why is it that when Daniel Schrader and Pierre Bien-Aimé sit down behind audio mixing equipment, they're said to produce the gist, but when a family of possums chew on the wires of the mixing board, they're said to be not aiding at all in the production of a podcast? The gist. Why is it when, in Tim Alberta's book, John Boehner called Mark Meadows, quote, a perfect fucking idiot, it seems plausible, but when Mark Meadows calls a mongoose a funny kind of slinky dog, we just think it's funny. Oom-pru-de-pru-du-pru, and thanks for listening.